The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. On today's program, we'll begin with an article titled Into the Great Beyond by Peter Ross. A ramble through Paris's historic cemeteries reveals how the city reimagined private remembrance as a vital part of public life. One summer afternoon in Père Lachaise, the sprawling cemetery in the east of Paris, a white-haired man, neatly dressed, was tending his own grave. First, he brushed away a spider web that had formed in the corner of his chapel, a small box-like structure that he had chosen as his place of rest. He then swept the slabs that, in time, will be lifted to allow his coffin and that of his wife, Anne, to be lowered into the earth. On a stone shelf was a large camera, sculpted from black granite, its lens so polished that the man, a photographer named André Chabot, could be seen in reflection. Finally, he stooped, not without effort, to lift a few strips of film brought as offerings by tourists, then wound these around the black metal gate at the front of the chapel. Chabot has longish hair and was wearing a gray jacket with a purple pocket square. A Leica camera was slung over his right shoulder. Now 84, he has been documenting cemeteries since he was 30, when he suffered three hard deaths in 1 year, the loss of both his maternal grandparents, his grandfather by suicide, and his newborn daughter. He has traveled widely in pursuit of this passion, taking 250,000 pictures. "If I photograph every cemetery in the world," he told me, half-joking, "then I will never die." He fears death and does not believe in an afterlife, yet he yearns for some sort of eternity. "I want to be not forgotten. The solution." The solution? A prominent location in Père Lachaise, which receives around 3 million visitors a year. His chapel, built from limestone in 1850 for one Anna Margarita Kutz, was repurposed by Chabot in 2013. Père Lachaise, being prestigious, graves are in high demand. Space for newcomers is limited, but places become available through various means. Every year, the cemetery repossesses around 120 plots, often because they have fallen into disrepair. The remains are exhumed and moved to an ossuary, which is what happened with the bones of Madame Kutz. The monument is usually broken up, unless it has historic or aesthetic value, as this chapel does. Sitting on a busy route, close to the burial place of the French pop star Alain Bauchung, who died in 2009, Chabot's grave is hard to miss. A QR code on the front directs the curious to his website. When he is gone, he will not be gone. People will still say his name, wonder about his life, look at his black and white pictures of angels and cherubs, crosses and skulls. "The show," he said with a smile, "must go on." Paris, the city of light, is also the city of death. It is a place where the dead are mythologized and memorialized with operatic intensity. The historic cemeteries, not only Père Lachaise, but also Montmartre and Montparnasse, among others, are theatrical and elegiac, the lives of celebrated citizens hymned in bronze and stone. The famous catacombs, with subterranean streets of unsung skulls, have a different grandeur, austere and uncanny. The very name seems to strike a lachrymose note. Paris's greatest aria, however, is Père Lachaise. This is the best-known cemetery in Europe and perhaps the world. The graves of Edith Piaf, Frédéric Chopin, and Oscar Wilde are among the most visited of its 70,000 or so tombs. Wilde lies beneath a flying demon angel, as its sculptor Jacob Epstein described the figure. He carved it in London from a 20-ton limestone block and in 1912 had it transported to Paris, where it was immediately controversial its visible genitals considered indecent. In 1961, the offending parts were smashed off by vandals, two English women, the story goes, and have been missing since. Do you really keep Oscar Wilde's balls on your desk? Is a question the cemetery manager is sometimes asked. He always denies it, and all I can add, having been in his office, is that I myself did not see them. Père Lachaise's popularity is thanks in part to such legends. It is a place of story as much as stone, but perhaps more to the way it looks. Its worn and melancholy charm hits the Instagram sweet spot. It fits our idea of how an old cemetery should appear. That is because it invented the idea. Père Lachaise opened in 1804, the same year Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte decreed that France's cemeteries should be built just outside city limits. There was to be an end to burials and mass graves, no more corpses crammed into churchyards already full to bursting. The dead had been a problem for Paris since the mid-18th century. A notorious incident in 1780 scandalized the city when a basement wall on Rue de la Lingerie, bordering on the Cemetery of the Holy Innocents, collapsed inward under the thronging weight of the dead. The neighborhood stank of rotting flesh, and people fainted in the street. The solution was to close the cemetery and transfer its occupants to a disused quarry outside the city. In 1786, the municipal ossuary, soon to be known as the Paris Catacombs, came into use. The problem of dead bodies became even more acute during the French Revolution. Where to store the abundant harvest of the guillotine? As the historian Erin-Marie Lagasse observes in her book Making Space for the Dead, the only thing worse than a pile of decomposing bodies in the middle of one's neighborhood was a pile of decomposing bodies without their heads. Such situations were not just disturbing, but a public health crisis. Vapors released by the bodies were believed to be the cause of disease. The new cemeteries established under Napoleon outside the city walls were nothing like the grim churchyards. The first of these, the Cimetière de l'Est, as Père Lachaise was known in its earliest days, was built in a hilly area on Paris's eastern outskirts. Eventually named for François Dieux de Lachaise, Father Lachaise, a prominent Jesuit priest who once provided over the estate on which the cemetery was built, it was designed as elegantly landscaped garden, a place where one could breathe as well as grieve. The cemetery now receives 8,000 visitors most days, and as many as 12,000 on Sundays, but is big enough to absorb those numbers and still seem peaceful. Its 110 acres are laid out like a quaint little town, complete with cobbled streets and attractive signs. You can get lost there, especially in the so-called romantic sector, where grid-like avenues give way to small winding paths and parakeets screech through the trees. This new type of graveyard soon proved influential. Père Lachaise is father to the rural cemetery movement that saw large burial grounds open in the countryside near America's rapidly growing cities. There were a great many more citizens and a great many more dead. The first of the new cemeteries built to accommodate them, Mount Auburn in Cambridge, Massachusetts, was directly inspired by the layout and monuments of Père Lachaise, and it became a popular spot for Bostonians keen to stroll the grounds and enjoy the pleasures of landscape. In the mid-19th century, Mount Auburn was a major tourist destination in the United States. Its success led to the establishment of smaller cemeteries, including Oak Hill in Washington, D.C., and Greenwood in New York, and the popularity of such verdant spaces inspired, in turn, the establishment of sprawling urban parks. Thus, the Parisian cemetery, in a curious way, is the grandfather of Manhattan's Central Park, Grand Père Lachaise. On a warm morning in June, I walked out of the metro beneath the station's pretty Art Nouveau sign and passed the unturning sails of the Moulin Rouge. Commuter traffic growled over the Pont Caulaincourt, a bridge that, since 1888, has cut through Montmartre Cemetery. Observed through the bridge's steel lattice, the stone roofs of the funerary chapels resemble a townscape. A sign explained that the cemetery had opened in 1825, the third such burial place to be established in Paris, after Père Lachaise and Mount Parnasse. They had to do two rough drafts before they made the perfect cemetery. The curator, Pascal Cassandro, joked when we met in his office, just past the entrance. Montmartre, in the north of Paris, is the district most associated with the city's artistic history in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and this is reflected in its graves. The painter Edgar Degas is buried here as well, as is Hector Berlioz. The cemetery was the composer's favorite place to walk, especially in the rain. In 1864, he had the remains of his first wife, the Shakespearean actress Harriet Smithson, exhumed and moved to the vault that he intended as his own. The gravedigger bent down and with his two hands picked up the head, already parted from the body, Berlioz recalled in his memoir. Then, bending down again with difficulty, he gathered in his arms the headless trunk and limbs, a blackish mass where the shroud still clung to it, like a damp sack with a lump of pitch in it. Berlioz was 60 and ready, even eager, to follow Smithson into the grave, which he did 5 years later. Around 3/4 of the cemetery's visitors are tourists. Most of the rest are locals and people visiting loved ones, some so regular that the staff know them by the hours they keep. La Dame de 8 heures used to visit the grave of her parents at 8 every morning before work, but now she comes at 2 p.m. and is known as La Dame de 14 heures. Then there's a gentleman who arrives at 3:42 with an air of somber distance and walks to his wife's resting place. When he leaves at 4:18 p.m., he's much more approachable. He stops and chats, may even tell a joke, and then crosses the street to a cafe, does a crossword puzzle, and goes home. Montmartre has a resident population of tens and thousands of dead people and some 40 living cats. Chief among the latter is Victor, a large black and white tom who can often be found curled in sleep on a sun-warmed gravestone. Victor is le patron, the boss of the cemetery, a position of supremacy earned through long service and ready claws. He once held territory by the extraordinary tomb of Dalida, the singer who took her own life in 1987, and whose grave is topped by a life-size marble statue. But he has since annexed the zone around the cemetery's entrance, where snacks are easier to come by. Cats inhabit Parisian cemeteries in part because of an unfortunate tradition of abandoning unwanted pets there. It is said that in the 1980s, as many as 400 were living among Montmartre's graves. Since 1978, volunteers with an organization called L'École du Chat, the cat school, and its offshoots, have cared for cemetery strays, feeding them, neutering them, taking sick animals to the vet, and giving them names. At present, for example, the cemetery of Saint-Ouen, a little north of Montmartre, is home to Mercedes, Smurfette, Clarence, Honey, the sewer guy, Melo, Missy, Mucci, Colucha, and Zorro. I was told this by Nathalie Rossi, the treasurer of L'École du Chat de Paris, who was involved in their care. The serene atmosphere of a cemetery is conducive to a cat's rhythm of life, she explained. They can hunt, nap, and slink unseen through the undergrowth, and they benefit from the concern of people, often very lonely, who bring them food while visiting the graves of loved ones. A cemetery, to these small creatures, is a place not of death, but of life, and Rossi suggested. They can help us see it as such, too. The presence of cats in the cemetery brings warmth and life to the place, just like singing birds. There's nothing more aesthetically pleasing than a cat lying languidly on a grave. It is common to find offerings at the graves of the famous dead, and common for traditions to develop and evolve. Every July 3rd, the anniversary of Jim Morrison's death in Paris, a crowd gathers by his resting place in Père Lachaise. From the open window of a nearby ground floor apartment drifts an eerie guitar. Then comes a tambourine shake and a familiar doomy baritone. This is the end, beautiful friend. The Doors frontman's funeral in 1971 is said to have lasted less than 10 minutes. The filmmaker Agnès Varda, later buried in another Parisian cemetery, attended, and she said she was only one of four people there. Since then, Morrison's plot, fenced off and topped by an unremarkable stone block, has become a kind of martyr's grave, sometimes attracting greater numbers and riskier behavior than the cemetery has been able to handle. 20 or so years ago. Management considered it a headache that he was buried there. Now they consider it an honor. And they recently took steps to make his tomb more accessible by digging up four 19th century graves and landscaping the area so that wheelchair users could draw near. And why not? The vibe these days is comradely and chill. The problems of sex and drugs at the grave are in the past, one hears, because the fans got old. Life moves on, even in a graveyard. When I first went to Montparnasse Cemetery 25 years ago, I visited the grave of the great French singer-songwriter Serge Gainsbourg. His stone was covered with objects that suggested a desire to share his pleasures. Half-empty bottles of champagne, half-smoked cigarettes. On returning not long ago, I found none of that. Instead, there was a fresh cabbage, a reference to his record L'Homme de Tête de Chou, the man with the cabbage head, and a metal pail full of subway tickets left in tribute to Le Pomponneur de Lila, a popular 1958 song about a Metro employee driven to thoughts of shooting himself by the futility of endlessly punching holes in billets. Jane Birkin, Gainsbourg's former partner, collaborator, and muse, died in 2023. Her ashes were interred only a short walk away. A cuddly stuffed monkey, I noticed, sat on her grave, an homage to the cover of the classic Gainsbourg album Histoire de Melodie Nelson, on which she holds a similar toy. Birkin placed the original monkey next to the singer in his coffin to act as a guardian in the afterlife. As soon as a famous person is laid to rest, they are absorbed into the history of the place. Narrative is greedy. It demands new characters and storylines. I asked Thierry Leroy, one of Paris's best-known cemetery guides, how long he waited after a burial before including a celebrity in his tour. "I don't wait," he replied. Montparnasse, unlike Hilly Père Lachaise and Montmartre, is flat. The Montparnasse Tower, a huge dark office block, looms like Kubrick's monolith beyond the cemetery wall. To the right of the main entrance is the shared grave of the intellectuals Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. He died in 1980. She outlived him by 6 years, during which time she addressed him in print. "You are in your little box. You will not come out of it, and I shall not join you there. Even if I'm buried next to you, there will be no communication between your ashes and mine." It is a supremely dispassionate view, and yet their simple pale headstone has become, in a way, a symbol of human connection and love. It was covered when I visited in bright red lipstick kisses. Lipstick has also been used to color the names on the stone. The top of the grave could hardly be seen for bouquets of flowers and many notes, most in Chinese characters, written on the back of postcards, scraps of paper, and cardboard strips torn from a box of sanitary pads. Kissing the grave is a new phenomenon. Cemetery workers wash the lipstick off, but it keeps coming back. This craze is perhaps driven by social media, and yet it seems to belong to an older tradition of shrines and holy relics. A few young women were gathered around the grave, taking pictures of one another and writing notes that they placed among the flowers on the stone. "This woman is Simone, and she is a feminist in Paris," one told me, in English, using the present tense. "We are from China, and we learn from her. We get power from her. In China, there are a lot of unfair situations between men and women. So, reading her book, The Second Sex, we learn a lot. You came here because of the book?" I asked. "Yeah, exactly." After they had gone, I took pictures of the notes and later had them translated. They all thanked Beauvoir in the warmest terms for strength and inspiration of her work. "As a girl from a small town," one wrote, "I finally achieved my dream of coming to a bigger world." Another said, "I had to come to France. I had to see you." This is the power of cemeteries. They offer the false intimacy of the grave. We stand at the place where a body lies and feel a stronger connection to that person than we would elsewhere. It is a familiar experience in the places where our own loved ones rest. But it is also true of strangers who have somehow become important to us. In this way, cemeteries are libraries of the dead. Each stone is a life to read and ponder. How we read a graveyard depends on who we are. Different eyes and minds see it in different ways. For example, when I walked one morning through Père Lachaise in the company of the journalist and author Camille Paix, I found a different cemetery from the one I thought I knew. Paix was showing me Mère Lachaise, Mother Lachaise, a name she had coined to express her feminist reading of the place. While waiting for her to arrive, I had looked at the Père Lachaise map displayed just inside the entrance. Of the 114 famous names, 15 were women. All those grand hommes, not many grand femmes. Pax campaigns to correct the imbalance, raising public awareness of women who she feels deserve to be better known. On Toussaint, All Saints Day, November 1st, the grounds of French cemeteries are bright with chrysanthemums and crowded with people visiting the graves of family and friends. In recent years, Pax has organized a feminist Toussaint as a public event. She and fellow activists take flowers to dozens of the dead and speak about their lives and achievements. It's an act of remembrance and celebration, she said. It's about telling their stories in a joyous way. She took me to visit a few. First, we called upon the photojournalist Gerda Taro, who was killed in 1937 while covering the Spanish Civil War. And then we walked to the resting place of the American writer and art collector Gertrude Stein and her life partner Alice B. Toklas. Pax pointed out that eminent men often have sculpted likenesses on their graves. The novelist Balzac, for instance, is depicted with strong features and splendid leonine hair. But female statues is mostly restricted to pleureuses, weeping women, blandly beautiful symbols of grief. A man can be seen on his grave as a living person, Pax said. Women just represent ideas or are at the service of mourning the great man. Stein, who in life appeared to be hewed from stone, would make a fine bust. The final stop on our tour was the grave of painter and sculptor Rosa Bonheur, who died in 1899. Her tomb is decorated with a swooping palm branch. A little paintbrush has been tucked behind the bronze leaves, perhaps the start of a new tradition. Other visitors seeing it may do the same, and in this way the tomb will become ever more visible. 6 years ago, when Pax first started showing people around Père Lachaise, almost nobody knew who Bonheur was. They knew the name but couldn't place her. Now she and her work are much better known. It is a form of resurrection, a reputation reborn in part from the place where the body lies. Pax put it in a different way. Graves have a life of their own. The workers were on strike, so the catacombs had closed to the public, but I could still go down. Hélène Fermineau said she would take me. It would be just us and 6 million dead. I say 6 million, but it could be 3 million, or 4 million, or five. The precise figure is uncertain. The catacombs are a series of ossuaries, places for keeping bones, and Fermineau is in charge of communications, a spokesperson for skulls. We met at the entrance, a former toll house in the south of Paris, and she led the way to a spiral staircase that would take us into a former quarry 65 feet beneath the streets. You really feel, she said, that you're going down, down, down in time. 131 steps later, we were lower than the metro, lower than the sewers. We had gone below the belly of the city and were passing through its guts. The catacombs received their first bones from the Cemetery of the Holy Innocents. The exhumations from the cemetery, where citizens had been laid to rest since at least the 12th century, were carried out by night and took more than a year. A 1787 illustration by Jean-Nicolas Saube depicts an infernal scene. Light and smoke rise from a great pit, illuminating the homes and the church overlooking the cemetery. Priests chant the office of the dead while a coffin is raised on ropes. A cart stands ready to rattle the bones over the Paris streets. Just beyond the city walls, the remains were tipped down a deep quarry shaft, which is why none of the skulls in the catacombs have their lower jaws. They broke off in impact. The souls of the dead were treated with greater care than the bodies. The quarry was consecrated to make it fit for a Christian burial. Limestone quarries, some dating to the medieval period, honeycombed the ground beneath the great city. In the second half of the 18th century, houses and streets started to collapse into the galleries below. To save citizens from the abyss, the quarries were condemned and stone pillars were constructed to hold up the roof. This required further tunneling, the result of which is that the plan of southern Paris, as it was in the late 1700s, has its mirror image below ground. The streets of the subterranean city cover more than 180 miles, of which the ossuaries form a tiny part. In 1809, city authorities decided to allow the public to visit this strange land of the dead, and the catacombs, much as we see them now, were laid out. Arrêtez, C'est ici l'empire de l'amour. Formino read aloud the words carved into the lintel above the entrance. There was nothing actorly in her intonation. The instruction was dramatic enough. Stop. Here is the empire of death. We did stop just for a moment, then went on. Right away, we were among the bones. They were stacked about 5 feet high on either side of us. Three layers of skulls divided walls of femurs and tibiae, their joint ends facing the passage, suggesting flowers or butterflies. The skulls were biscuit brown, eye sockets dim, dark in the dim light. You can get right up to them face to face, but touching is not allowed. Stealing, a sign explains, carries a fine of 15,000 euro and up to 1 year in prison. There are lots of gaps where skulls over the past couple centuries have been stolen. Staff check bags at the exit. The corridors go on and on. Beyond the walls, called hags, stretching more than a dozen yards into the darkness, is a chaos of smaller bones. These are believed to represent most of the population of Paris between the 12th and 18th centuries. The catacombs are a shadow version of Père Lachaise. In the great cemetery, you see no human remains, but from the graves, you learn something of the people buried there. The ossuary presents the opposite. All the bodies, none of the stories. The first impression is that all skulls look the same, Firmino said. But when you are in the deep, calm silence of the catacombs, and you take the time to look at them individually, you really see and feel the difference. I find it full of emotion because you realize that each person had some joy and sadness in life. We paused by a stretch of wall in which 14 heads had been arranged in a pattern of a heart. Don't you think this one looks a little angry? She asks, pointing to a skull with a distinctive frown. Perhaps it is Robespierre, I said. The revolutionary leader was put to death in 1794. A lot of those who were guillotined during the terror are here, Firmino said, nodding, and the people who ordered their execution are also here. So they are reunited in death, not as lovers, but as people who hated each other. And we are going to pause the article there because we're running out of time, but we will pick this up next week. As I said, we've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Kepin family. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.